and by the time the sun came up, they were halfway back to Harrenhal. Jamie pushed his horse much harder than he had the day before, and still Shanks and the Northmen were forced to match his pace. Even so, it was midday before they reached the castle on the lake. Beneath a darkening sky that threatened rain, the immense walls and five great towers stood black and ominous.
It looked so dead.
The walls were empty, the gates closed and barred. But high above the barbican, a single banner hung limp.
The Black Goat of Cawhor,
he knew. Jamie cupped his hands to shout, "You in there! Open your gates, or I'll kick them down!" It was not until Kyburn and Steelshanks added their voices that a head finally appeared on the battlements above them. He goggled down at them, then vanished. A short time later, they heard the portcullis being drawn upward. The gates swung open, and Jamie Lannister spurred his horse through the walls, scarcely glancing at the murder holes as he passed beneath them. He had been worried that the goat might not admit them, but it seemed as if the brave companions still thought of them as allies.
Fools!
The outer ward was deserted. Only the long, slate-roof stables showed any sign of life, and it was not horses that interested Jamie just then. He reined up and looked about. He could hear sounds from somewhere behind the Tower of Ghosts, and men shouting in half a dozen tongues. Steelshanks and Kyburn rode up on either side.
"Get what you came back for, and we'll be gone again," said Walton. "I want no trouble with the mummers.
Tell your men to keep their hands on their sword hilts, and the mummers will want no trouble with you. 2-1, remember?"
Jamie's head jerked round at the sound of a distant roar, faint but ferocious. It echoed off the walls of Harrenhal, and the laughter swelled up like the sea. All of a sudden, he knew what was happening.
"Have we come too late?"
His stomach did a lurch, and he slammed his spurs into his horse, galloping across the outer ward, beneath an arched stone bridge, around the Wailing Tower, and through the flowstone yard. They had her in the bear pit. King Harren the Black had wished to do even his bear-baiting in lavish style. The pit was 10 yards across and 5 yards deep, walled in stone, floored with sand, and encircled by 6 tiers of marble benches. The brave companions filled only a quarter of the seats Jamie saw as he swung down clumsily from his horse. The sellswords were so fixed on the spectacle beneath that only those across the pit noticed their arrival. Brian wore the same ill-fitting gown she'd worn to supper with Roose Bolton. No shield, no breastplate, no chainmail, not even boiled leather. Only pink satin and Moorish lace. Maybe the goat thought she was more amusing when dressed as a woman. Half her gown was hanging off in tatters, and her left arm dripped blood where the bear had raked her.
At least they gave her a sword.
The wench held it one-handed, moving sideways, trying to put some distance between her and the bear.
"That's no good. The ring's too small."
She needed to attack, to make a quick end to it. Good steel was a match for any bear, but the wench seemed afraid to close. The mummer showered her with insults and obscene suggestions.
"This is none of our concern," Steelshanks warned Jamie. "Lord Bolton said the wench was theirs, to do with as they liked."
"Her name's Brian." Jamie descended the steps past a dozen startled sellswords. Vargo Hote had taken the Lord's box in the lowest tier.
"Lord Vargo!"
he called above the shouts. The Cowhoric almost spilt his wine.
"Kingslayer!"
The left side of his face was bandaged clumsily, the linen over his ear spotted with blood.
"Pull her out of there! Stay out of this, Kingslayer, unless you'd like another stump."
He waved a wine cup.
"Your she-moth bit off my ear. Small wonder a father will not ransom such a freak."
A roar turned Jamie back around. The bear was 8 feet tall.
Gregor Clegane with a pelt, he thought, though likely smarter.
The beast did not have the reach the mountain had with that monstrous greatsword of his, though. Bellowing in fury, the bear showed a mouthful of great yellow teeth, then fell back to all fours and went straight at Brayeen.
"There's your chance," Jamie thought. "Strike now!"
Instead, she poked out ineffectually with the point of her blade. The bear recoiled, then came on, rumbling. Brayeen slid to her left and poked again at the bear's face. This time he lifted a paw to swat the sword aside.
"He's wary," Jamie realized. "He's gone up against other men. He knows that swords and spears can hurt him, but that won't keep him off her long."
"Kill him!" he shouted, but his voice was lost among all the other shouts. If Brayeen heard, she gave no sign. She moved around the pit, keeping the wall at her back.
"Too close! If the bear pins her by the wall!"
The beast turned clumsily. Too far and too fast. Quick as a cat, Brayeen changed direction.
"There's the wench I remember."
She leapt in to land a cut across the bear's back. Roaring, the beast went up on his hind legs again. Brayeen scrambled back away.
"Where's the blood?"
Then suddenly he understood. Jamie rounded on Holt.
"You gave her a tawny sword!"
The goat brayed laughter, spraying him with wine and spittle.
"Of course!"
"I'll pay a bloody ransom. Gold, sapphires, whatever you want. Pull her out of there."
"You want her? Go get her."
So he did. He put his good hand on the marble rail and vaulted over, rolling as he hit the sand. The bear turned at the thump, sniffing, watching this new intruder warily. Jamie scrambled to one knee.
"Well, what in seven hells do I do now?"
He filled his hand with sand.
"Kingslayer,"
he heard Brayeen say, astonished. "Jamie," he uncoiled, flinging the sand at the bear's face. The bear mauled the air and roared like blazes.
"What are you doing here?"
"Something stupid. Get behind me." He circled toward her, putting himself between Brayeen and the bear.
"You get behind. I have the sword."
"A sword with no point and no edge?
Get behind me."
He saw something half buried in the sand and snatched it up with his good hand. It proved to be a human jawbone, with some greenish flesh still clinging to it, crawling with maggots.
"Charming," he thought, wondering whose face he held.
The bear was edging closer, so Jamie whipped his arm around and flung bone, meat, and maggots at the beast's head. He missed by a good yard.
"I ought to lop my left hand off as well, for all the good it does me."
Brayeen tried to dart around, but he kicked her legs out from under her. She fell in the sand, clutching the useless sword. Jamie straddled her, and the bear came charging. There was a deep twang, and a feather shaft sprouted suddenly beneath the bear's left eye. Blood and slaver ran from his open mouth, and another bolt took him in the leg. The bear roared, reared. He saw Jamie and Brayeen again and lumbered toward them. More crossbows fired, the quarrels ripping through fur and flesh. At such short range, the bowman could hardly miss. The shafts hit as hard as maces, but the bear took another step. The poor, dumb, brave brute. When the beast swiped at him, he danced aside, shouting, kicking sand. The bear turned to follow his tormentor and took another two quarrels in the back. He gave one last rumbling growl, settled back on his haunches, stretched out on the blood-stained sand, and died. Brayeen got to her knees, clutching the sword and breathing short, ragged breaths. Steelshank's archers were winding their crossbows and reloading, while the bloody mummers shouted curses and threats at them. Rorg and Three Toes had swords out, Jamie saw, and Zola was uncoiling his whip.
"You slew my bear!"
Varga Holt shrieked.
"'And I'll serve you the same, if you give me trouble,' Steelshanks threw back. "'We're taking the wench.'
"'Her name is Brian,' Jamie said. "'Brian, the maid of Tarth. "'You are still maiden, I hope?' "'Her broad, homely face turned red. "'Yes.' "'Oh, good,' Jamie said. "'I only rescue maidens.' "'To Hote he said, "'You'll have your ransom, for both of us. "'A Lannister pays his debts. "'Now fetch some ropes and get us out of here.'
"'Bugger that!' Roar growled. "'Kill them, Hote, or you'll bloody well wish you had!'
"'The Kohorik hesitated. "'Half his men were drunk, the Northmen stone sober, "'and there were twice as many. "'Some of the crossbowmen had reloaded by now.'
"'Pull them out,' Hoth said, and then to Jamie, "'I have chosen to be merciful. Tell your lord father.'
"'I will, my lord. Not that it will do you any good.' Not until they were half a league from Harrenhal and out of range of archers on the walls did Steelshanks Walton let his anger show.
"'Are you mad, Kingslayer? Did you mean to die?' No man can fight a bear with his bare hands.
One bare hand and one bare stump, Jamie corrected. But I hoped you'd kill the beast before the beast killed me. Elsewise, Lord Bolton would have peeled you like an orange, no? Steelshanks cursed him roundly for a fool of Lannister, spurred his horse, and galloped away up the column.
Sir Jamie...
Even in soiled pink satin and torn lace, Brian looked more like a man in a gown than a proper woman.
"'I am grateful, but you were well away. Why come back?'
A dozen quips came to mind, each crueler than the one before. But Jamie only shrugged.
"'I dreamed of you,' he said.
Catelyn. Rob bid farewell to his young queen thrice. Once in the God's Wood before the Harp Tree, in sight of gods and men, the second time beneath the portcullis, where Jane had sent him forth with a long embrace and a longer kiss, and finally, an hour beyond the tumblestone, when the girl came galloping up on a well-lathered horse to plead with her young king to take her along. Rob was touched by that, Catelyn saw, but abashed as well. The day was damp and grey, a drizzle had begun to fall, and the last thing he wanted was to call a halt to his march, so that he could stand in the wet and console a tearful young wife in front of half his army. "'He speaks her gently,' she thought, as she watched them together, but there is anger underneath. All the time the king and queen were talking, grey wind prowled around them, stopping only to shake the water from his coat and bare his teeth at the rain. When at last Rob gave Jane one final kiss, dispatched a dozen men to take her back to River Run, and mounted his horse once more, the direwolf raced off ahead as swift as an arrow loosed from a longbow.
"'Queen Jane has a loving heart, I see,' said lame Lothar Frey to Catelyn. "'Nothing like my own sisters. Why, I would wager a guess that even now Roslyn is dancing around the twins, chanting, "'Lady Tolly, Lady Tolly, Lady Roslyn Tolly!' By the morrow she'll be holding swatches of River Run red and blue to her cheek to picture how she'll look in her bride's cloak.'
He turned in the saddle to smile at Edmure.
"'But you are strangely quiet, Lord Tully. How do you feel, I wonder?'
"'Much as I did at the stone mill just before the war horn sounded,' Edmure said, only half in jest. Lothar gave a good-natured laugh.
"'Let us pray your marriage ends as happily, my lord.'
"'And may the gods protect us if it does not.' Catelyn pressed her heels into her horse, leaving her brother and lame Lothar to each other's company. It had been her who had insisted that Jane remain at River Run, when Rob would sooner have kept her by his side.
Lord Walder might well construe the Queen's absence from the wedding as another slight. Yet her presence would have been a different sort of insult, salt in the old man's wound. "Walder Frey has a sharp tongue and a long memory," she had warned her son. "I do not doubt that you are strong enough to suffer an old man's rebukes as the price of his allegiance. But you have too much of your father in you to sit there while he insults Jane to her face." Rob could not deny the sense of that.
"Yet all the same, he resents me for it,"
Catelyn thought wearily. "He misses Jane already, and some part of him blames me for her absence, though he knows it was good counsel." Of the six Westerlings who had come with her son from the crag, only one remained by his side, Sir Reynold, Jane's brother, the royal banner-bearer. Rob had dispatched Jane's uncle, Rolf Spicer, to deliver young Martin Lannister to the Golden Tooth, the very day he received Lord Tywin's assent to the exchange of captives. It was deftly done. Her son was relieved of his fear for Martin's safety. Gorbert Glover was relieved to hear that his brother Robert had been put on a ship at Duskendale. Sir Rolf had important honourable employment, and Grey Wind was at the king's side once more, where he belongs. Lady Westerling had remained at River Run with her children, Jane, her little sister Elena, and young Rollam, Rob Squire, who complained bitterly about being left. Yet that was wise as well. Oliver Frey had squired for Rob previously, and would doubtless be present for his sister's wedding. To parade his replacement before him would be as unwise as it was unkind. As for Sir Reynold, he was a cheerful young knight who swore that no insult of Walder Frey's could possibly provoke him. And let us pray that insults are all we need to contend with. Catelyn had her fears on that score, though. Her lord father had never trusted Walder Frey after the Trident, and she was ever mindful of that. Queen Jane would be safest behind the high, strong walls of River Run, with a blackfish to protect her. Rob had even created him a new title, Warden of the Southern Marches. Sir Brynden would hold the Trident, if any man could. All the same, Catelyn would miss her uncle's craggy face, and Rob would miss his counsel. Sir Brynden had played a part in every victory her son had won. Gorbert Glover had taken command of the scouts and outriders in his place. A good man, loyal and steady, but without the Blackfish's brilliance. Behind Glover's screen of scouts, Rob's line of march stretched several miles. The Great John led the van. Catelyn travelled in the main column, surrounded by plodding war horses with steel-clad men on their backs. Next came the baggage train, a procession of wains laden with food, fodder, camp supplies, wedding gifts, and the wounded too weak to walk, under the watchful eye of Sir Wendell Manderley and his White Harbour knights. Herds of sheep and goats and scrawny cattle trailed behind, and then a little tail of footsore camp followers. Even farther back was Robin Flint and the rear guard. There was no enemy in back of them for hundreds of leagues, but Rob would take no chances. 3,500 they were, 3,500 who had been blooded in the Whispering Wood, who had reddened their swords at the Battle of the Camps, at Ox Cross, Ashmark, and the Crag, and all through the gold-rich hills of the Lannister West. Aside from her brother Edmure's modest retinue of friends, the lords of the Trident had remained to hold the riverlands while the king retook the north. Ahead awaited Edmure's bride and Rob's next battle. And for me, two dead sons, an empty bed, and a castle full of ghosts. It was a cheerless prospect. Brian, where are you? Bring my girls back to me, Brian. Bring them back, safe. The drizzle that had sent them off turned into a soft, steady rain by midday, and continued well past nightfall. The next day, the Northmen never saw the sun at all, but rode beneath leaden skies, with their hoods pulled up to keep the water from their eyes. It was a heavy rain, turning roads to mud and fields to quagmires, swelling the rivers and stripping the trees of their leaves. The constant patter made idle chatter more bother than it was worth, so men spoke only when they had something to say, and that was seldom enough.
"We are stronger than we seem, my lady," Lady Mage Mormont said as they rode. Catelyn had grown fond of Lady Mage and her eldest daughter, Daisy. They were more understanding than most in the matter of Jaime Lannister she had found. The daughter was tall and lean, the mother short and stout, but they dressed alike in mail and leather, with a black bear of House Mormont on shield and surcoat. By Catelyn's lights, that was queer garb for a lady, yet Daisy and Lady Mage seemed more comfortable, both as warriors and as women, than ever the girl from Tarth had been.
"I have fought beside the young wolf in every battle," Daisy Mormont said cheerfully. "He has not lost one yet."
"No, but he's lost everything else," Catelyn thought. But it would not do to say it aloud. The Northmen did not lack for courage, but they were far from home, with little enough to sustain them but for their faith in their young king. That faith must be protected at all costs. "I must be stronger," she told herself. "I must be strong for Rob. If I despair, my grief will consume me." Everything would turn on this marriage. If Edmure and Rosalind were happy in one another, if the late Lord Frey could be appeased and his power once more wedded to Rob's, even then, what chance will we have, caught between Lannister and Greyjoy? It was a question Catelyn dared not dwell on, though Rob dwelt on little else. She saw how he studied his maps whenever they made camp, searching for some plan that might win back the North. Her brother Edmure had other cares. "You don't suppose all Lord Walder's daughters look like him, do you?" he wondered, as he sat in his tall, striped pavilion with Catelyn and his friends. "With so many different mothers, a few of the maids are bound to turn up comely," said Sir Mark Piper. "But why should the old wretch give you a pretty one?" "No reason at all," said Edmure in a glum tone. It was more than Catelyn could stand. "Cersei Lannister is comely," she said sharply. "You'd be wiser to pray that Rosalind is strong and healthy, with a good head and a loyal heart." And with that she left them. Edmure did not take that well. The next day he avoided her entirely on the march, preferring the company of Mark Piper, Lyman Goodbrook, Patrick Mallister, and the young Vances. "They do not scold him, except in jest," Catelyn told herself when they raced by her that afternoon with nary a word. "I have always been too hard with Edmure, and now grief sharpens my every word." She regretted her rebuke. There was rain enough falling from the sky without her making more. And was it really such a terrible thing to want a pretty wife? She remembered her own childish disappointment the first time she had laid eyes on Eddard Stark. She had pictured him as a younger version of his brother, Brandon. But that was wrong. Ned was shorter and plainer of face, and so somber. He spoke courteously enough, but beneath the words she sensed a coolness that was all at odds with Brandon, whose mirth had been as wild as his rages. Even when he took her maidenhood, their love had more of duty to it than of passion. "We made Rob that night, though. We made a king together. And after the war, at Winterfell, I had love enough for any woman, once I found the good sweetheart beneath Ned's solemn face. There is no reason Edmure should not find the same with his Rosalind." As the gods would have it, their route took them through the Whispering Wood, where Rob had won his first great victory. They followed the course of the twisting stream on the floor of that pinched narrow valley, much as Jaime Lannister's men had done that fateful night. It was warmer then, Catelyn remembered,
The trees were still green, and the stream did not overflow its banks. Fallen leaves choked the flow now, and lay in sudden snarls among the rocks and roots, and the trees that had once hidden Rob's army had exchanged their green raiment for leaves of dull gold spotted with brown, and a red that reminded her of rust and dry blood. Only the spruce and the soldier pines still showed green, thrusting up at the belly of the clouds like tall dark spears. More than the trees have died since then, she reflected. On the night of the Whispering Wood, Ned was still alive in his cell beneath Aegon's high hill. Bran and Rickon were safe behind the walls of Winterfell, and Theon Greyjoy fought at Rob's side and boasted of how he had almost crossed swords with the Kingslayer. Would that he had. If Theon had died in place of Lord Carstark's sons, how much ill would have been undone. As they passed through the battleground, Catelyn glimpsed signs of the carnage that had been. An overturned helm filled with rain, a splintered lance, the bones of a horse. Stone cairns had been raised over some of the men who had fallen here, but scavengers had already been at them. Amidst the tumbles of rock, she spied brightly coloured cloth and bits of shiny metal. Once she saw a face peering out at her, the shape of the skull beginning to emerge beneath the melting brown flesh. It made her wonder where Ned had come to rest. The Silent Sisters had taken his bones north, escorted by Hellas Mollan and a small honour guard. Had Ned ever reached Winterfell, to be interred beside his brother Brandon in the dark crypts beneath the castle? Or did the door slam shut at Moat Cailin before Hal and the sisters could pass? 3,500 riders wound their way along the valley floor through the heart of the Whispering Wood, but Catelyn Stark had seldom felt lonelier. Every league she crossed took her father from Riverrun, and she found herself wondering whether she would ever see the castle again, or was it lost to her forever, like so much else? 5 days later, their scouts rode back to warn them that the rising waters had washed out the wooden bridge at Fairmarket. Gorbert Glover and two of his bolder men had tried swimming their mounts across the turbulent Blue Fork at Ramsford. Two of the horses had been swept under and drowned, and one of the riders. Glover himself managed to cling to a rock until they could pull him in.
"The river hasn't run this high since spring," Edmure said, "and if this rain keeps falling, it will go higher yet."
"There's a bridge further upstream near Oldstones," remembered Catelyn, who had often crossed these lands with her father. "It's older and smaller, but if it still stands—"
"It's gone, my lady," Gorbert Glover said. "Washed away, even before the one at Fairmarket."
Rob looked to Catelyn. "Is there another bridge?" "No. And the fords will be impassable." She tried to remember. "If we cannot cross the Blue Fork, we'll have to go round it, through Seven Streams and Hag's Mire. Bugs and bad roads, or none at all," warned Edmure.
"The going will be slow, but we'll get there, I suppose."
"Lord Waldo will wait, I'm sure," said Rob. "Lothar sent him a bird from Riverrun. He knows we are coming."
"Yes, but the man is prickly and suspicious by nature," said Catelyn. "He may take this delay as a deliberate insult."
"Very well. I'll beg his pardon for our tardiness as well.
A sorry king I'll be, apologizing with every second breath."
Rob made a wry face. "I hope Bolton got across the Trident before the rains began. The King's Road runs straight north. He'll have an easy march. Even afoot he should reach the Twins before us." "And when you've joined his men to yours and seen my brother married, what then?" Catelyn asked him.
"North."
Rob scratched Grey Wind behind an ear. "By the causeway, against Moat Cailin?" He gave her an enigmatic smile. "That's one way to go," he said. and she knew from his tone that he would say no more. A wise king keeps his own counsel, she reminded herself. They reached Oldstones after 8 more days of steady rain and made their camp upon the hill overlooking the Blue Fork, within a ruined stronghold of the ancient River Kings. Its foundations remained amongst the weeds to show where the walls and keeps had stood. But the local small folk had long ago made off with most of the stones to raise their barns and septs and holdfasts. Yet in the centre of what once would have been the castle's yard, a great carved sepulchre still rested, half hidden in waist-high brown grass amongst a stand of ash. The lid of the sepulchre had been carved into the likeness of the man whose bones lay beneath, but the rain and the wind had done their work. The king had worn a beard, they could see, but otherwise his face was smooth and featureless, with only vague suggestions of a mouth, a nose, eyes, and a crown about his temples. His hands folded over the shaft of a stone war hammer that lay upon his chest. Once the war hammer would have been carved with runes that told its name and history, but all that the centuries had worn away. The stone itself was cracked and crumbling at the corners, discolored here and there by spreading white splotches of lichen, while wild roses crept up over the king's feet almost to his chest. It was there that Catelyn found Rob, standing somber in the gathering dusk, with only a grey wind beside him. The rain had stopped for once, and he was bareheaded. "Does this castle have a name?" he asked quietly, when she came up to him. "Oldstones. All the small folk called it when I was a girl, but no doubt it had some other name when it was still a hall of kings. She had camped here once with her father, on their way to Seagard. Pataya was with us too. There's a song," he remembered, "Jenny of Oldstones, with the flowers in her hair." "We're all just songs in the end, if we are lucky." She had played at being Jenny that day, had even worn flowers in her hair, and Pataya had pretended to be her prince of dragonflies. Catelyn could not have been more than 12, Pataya just a boy. Rob studied the sepulchre. "Whose grave is this?" "Here lies Tristopher, the fourth of his name, king of the rivers and the hills. Her father had told her his story once. He ruled from the Trident to the Neck, thousands of years before Jenny and her prince, in the days when the kingdoms of the first men were falling one after the other before the onslaught of the Andals. The Hammer of Justice, they called him. He fought 100 battles and won 99, or so the singers say. And when he raised this castle, it was the strongest in Westeros." She put a hand on her son's shoulder. "He died in his 100th battle, when 7 Andal kings joined forces against him. The 5th, Tristopher, was not his equal, and soon the kingdom was lost, and then the castle, and last of all, the line. With Tristopher the 5th died House Mud, that had ruled the Riverlands for 1,000 years before the Andals came. His heir failed him." Rob ran a hand over the rough, weathered stone. "I had to hope to leave Jane with child. We tried often enough, but I'm not certain. It does not always happen the first time, though it did with you. Nor even the 100th. You are very young." "Young and a king," he said. "A king must have an heir. If I should die in my next battle, the kingdom must not die with me. By law, Sansa is next in line of succession, so Winterfell and the North would pass to her." His mouth tightened. "To her, and her lord husband, Tyrion Lannister." "I cannot allow that. I will not allow that. That dwarf must never have the North." "No," Catelyn agreed. "You must name another heir until such time as Jane gives you a son." She considered for a moment.
Your father's father had no siblings, but his father had a sister who married a younger son of Lord Raymar Royce, of the junior branch. They had three daughters, all of whom wed Vale lordlings, a Wainwood and a Corbray for certain. The youngest, it might have been a Templeton, but... Mother, there was a sharpness in Rob's tone. You forget. My father had four sons. She had not forgotten. She had not wanted to look at it. Yet there it was. A Snow is not a Stark. John's more a Stark than some lordlings from the Vale, who have never so much as set eyes on Winterfell. John is a brother of the Night's Watch, sworn to take no wife and hold no lands. Those who take the Black serve for life. So do the Knights of the King's Guard. That did not stop the Lannisters from stripping the white cloaks from Sir Barristan Selmy and Sir Boris Blunt, when they had no more use for them. If I send the Watch 100 men in John's place, I'll wager they'll find some way to release him from his vows. He is set on this. Catelyn knew how stubborn her son could be. A bastard cannot inherit. Not unless he's legitimized by a royal decree, said Rob. There is more precedent for that than for releasing a sworn brother from his oath. Precedent? She said bitterly. Yes, Aegon the Fourth legitimized all his bastards on his deathbed. And how much pain, grief, war, and murder grew from that? I know you trust John, but can you trust his sons, or their sons? The Blackfyre Pretenders troubled the Tregarians for 5 generations, until Barristan the Bold slew the last of them on the Stepstones. If you make John legitimate, there is no way to turn him bastard again. Should he wed and breed, any sons you may have by Jane will never be safe. John would never harm a son of mine. No more than Theon Greyjoy would harm Bran or Rickon. Greywind leapt up atop King Tristopher's crypt, his teeth bared. Rob's own face was cold. That is as cruel as it is unfair. John is no Theon. So you pray. Have you considered your sisters? What of their rights? I agree that the North must not be permitted to pass to the Imp, but what of Arya? By law, she comes after Sansa, your own sister, true-born. And dead. No one has seen or heard of Arya since they cut Father's head off. Why do you lie to yourself? Arya's gone, the same as Bran and Rickon, and they'll kill Sansa too, once a dwarf gets a child from her. John is the only brother that remains to me. Should I die without issue, I want him to succeed me as king in the North. I had hoped you would support my choice. I cannot, she said. In all else, Rob, in everything, but not in this folly. Do not ask it. I don't have to. I'm the king. Rob turned and walked off, Grey Wind bounding down from the tomb and loping after him. What have I done? Catelyn thought wearily, as she stood alone by Tristopher's stone sepulchre. First I anger Edmure, and now Rob. But all I have done is speak the truth. Are men so fragile they cannot bear to hear it? She might have wept then, had not the sky begun to do it for her. It was all she could do to walk back to her tent and sit there in the silence. In the days that followed, Rob was everywhere and anywhere, riding at the head of the van with a great John, scouting with Grey Wind, racing back to Robin Flint and the rear guard. Men said proudly that the young wolf was the first to rise each dawn and the last to sleep at night. But Catelyn wondered whether he was sleeping at all. He grows as lean and hungry as his direwolf. My lady, Maige Mormont said to her one morning as they rode through a steady rain, you seem so somber. Is aught amiss?
My lord husband is dead, as is my father. Two of my sons have been murdered. My daughter has been given to a faithless dwarf to bear his vile children. My other daughter has vanished and likely dead, and my last son and my only brother are both angry with me. What could possibly be amiss? That was more truth than Lady Mage would wish to hear, however. "This is an evil reign," she said instead. "We have suffered much, and there is more peril and more grief ahead. We need to face it boldly, with horns blowing and banners flying bravely. But this reign beats us down. The banners hang limp and sodden, and the men huddle under their cloaks and scarcely speak to one another. Only an evil reign would chill our hearts when most we need them to burn hot." Daisy Mormont looked up at the sky. "I would sooner have water raining down on me than arrows." Catelyn smiled despite herself. "You are braver than I fear. Are all your Bear Island women such warriors?"
"She bears, aye," said Lady Mage. "We have needed to be. In olden days the Iron Men would come raiding in their longboats or wildlings from the frozen shore. The men would be off fishing, like as not. The wives they left behind had to defend themselves and their children, or else be carried off." "There's a carving on our gate," said Daisy. "A woman in a bearskin with a child in one arm suckling at her breast. In the other hand she holds a battle-axe. She's no proper lady, that one, but I always loved her." "My nephew Jorah brought home a proper lady once," said Lady Mage. "He won her in a tourney. How she hated that carving!"
"Aye, and all the rest," said Daisy. "She had hair like spun gold, that Lyness. Skin like cream, but her soft hands were never made for axes."
"Nor her tits for giving suck," her mother said bluntly.
Catelyn knew of whom they spoke. Jorah Mormont had brought his second wife to Winterfell for feasts, and once they had guested for a fortnight. She remembered how young the Lady Lyness had been, how fair, and how unhappy. One night, after several cups of wine, she had confessed to Catelyn that the North was no place for a high tower of Old Town. "There was a Tully of River Run who felt the same once," she had answered gently, trying to console. But in time, she found much here she could love. All lost now, she reflected. Winterfell and Ned, Bran and Rickon, Sansa, Arya, all gone. Only Rob remains. Had there been too much Lyness Hightower in her, after all, and too little of the Starks? Would that I had known how to wield an axe. Perhaps I might have been able to protect them better. Day followed day, and still the rain kept falling. All the way up the Blue Fork they rode, past seven streams where the river unravelled into a confusion of rills and brooks, then through Hagsmire, where glistening green pools waited to swallow the unwary, and the soft ground sucked at the hooves of their horses like a hungry babe at its mother's breast. The going was worse than slow. Half the wains had to be abandoned to the muck, their loads distributed amongst mules and draft horses. Lord Jason Mallister caught up with them amidst the bugs of Hagsmire. There was more than an hour of daylight remaining when he rode up with his column, but Rob called a halt at once, and Sir Reynard Westerling came to escort Catelyn to the king's tent. She found her son seated beside a brazier, a map across his lap. Grey Wynne slept at his feet. The Great John was with him, along with Galbert Glover, Maege Mormont, Edmure, and a man that Catelyn did not know, a fleshy, balding man, with a cringing look to him. No lordling, this one. She knew the moment she laid eyes on the stranger. Not even a warrior. Jason Mallister rose to offer Catelyn his seat. His hair had almost as much white in it as brown, but the Lord of Seagard was still a handsome man, tall and lean, with a chiselled, clean-shaven face, high cheekbones, and fierce grey-blue eyes.
Lady Stark, it's ever a pleasure. I bring good tidings, I hope.
We are in sore need of some, my lord. She sat, listening to the rain patter down noisily against the canvas overhead. Rob waited for Sir Reynold to close the tent flap.
The guards have heard our prayers, my lords. Lord Jason has brought us the captain of the Mirraham, a merchanter out of Old Town. Captain, tell them what you told me.
Aye, your grace.
He licked his thick lips nervously. My last port of call afore Sea Guard was Lord's Port and Pike. The Iron Men kept me there more than half a year, they did. King Balin's command, only, well, the long and the short of it is, he's dead.
Balin Greyjoy?
Catelyn's heart skipped a beat. You are telling us that Balon Greyjoy is dead? The shabby little captain nodded.
You know how Pike's built on a headland, and part on rocks and islands off the shore with bridges between? The way I heard it in Lordsport, there was a blow coming in from the west, rain and thunder, and old King Balin was crossing one of them bridges when the wind got hold of it and just tore the thing to pieces. He washed up 2 days later, all bloated and broken. Crabs ate his eyes, I hear.
The great John laughed.
King crabs, I hope, to sup upon such royal jelly, eh?
The captain bobbed his head.
Aye, but that's not all of it, no.
He leaned forward.
The brother's back.
Victorian? Asked Gorbert Glover, surprised.
Euron. Crow's Eye, they call him. As black a pirate as ever raised a sail. He's been gone for years, but Lord Balin was no sooner called than there he was, sailing into Lordsport in his silence. Black sails and a red hull, and crewed by mutes. He'd been to a shy and back, I heard. Wherever he was, though, he's home now, and he marched right into Pike and sat his arse in the sea-stone chair and drowned Lord Botley in a cask of sea-water when he objected. That was when I ran back to Mirraham and slipped anchor, hoping I could get away while things were confused, and so I did. And here I am.
Captain, said Rob when the man was done, you have my thanks, and you will not go unrewarded. Lord Jason will take you back to your ship when we are done. Pray, wait outside.
That I will, your grace, that I will.
No sooner had he left the king's pavilion than the great John began to laugh, but Rob silenced him with a look. Euron Greyjoy is no man's notion of a king, if half of what Theon said of him was true. Theon is the rightful heir, unless he's dead, but Victarion commands the Iron Fleet. I can't believe he would remain at Moat Cailin, while Euron Crow's Eye holds the sea-stone chair. He has to go back. There's a daughter as well, Gorbert Glover reminded him. The one who holds Deepwood Mott, and Robert's wife and child.
If she stays at Deepwood Mott, that's all she can hope to hold, said Rob.
What's true for the brothers is even more true for her. She will need to sail home to oust Euron and press her own claim. Her son turned to Lord Jason Mallister.
You have a fleet at Sea Guard?
A fleet, your grace. Half a dozen longships and 2 war galleys, enough to defend my own shores against raiders, but I could not hope to meet the Iron Fleet in battle.
Nor would I ask it of you. The Ironborn will be setting sail toward Pike, I expect. Theon told me how his people think. Every captain a king on his own deck. They will all want a voice in the succession. My lord, I need 2 of your longships to sail around the Cape of Eagles and up the neck to Greywater Watch.
Lord Jason hesitated.
A dozen streams drain the wet wood, all shallow, silty, and uncharted. I would not even call them rivers. The channels are ever drifting and changing. There are endless sandbars, deadfalls, and tangles of rotting trees. And Greywater Watch moves. How am I ships to find it?
Go up river, flying my banner. The Krannock men will find you. I want two ships to double the chances of my message reaching Howland Reed. Lady May shall go on one, Galbot on the second. He turned to the two he'd named. You'll carry letters for those lords of mine who remain in the north, but all the commands within will be false, in case you have the misfortune to be taken. If that happens, you must tell them that you are sailing for the north, back to Bear Island, or for the Stony Shore. He tapped a finger on the map. Moat Cailin is the key. Lord Balin knew that, which is why he sent his brother Victarion there, with a hard heart of the Greyjoy strength.
Succession squabbles or no, the Arnborn are not such fools as to abandon Moat Cailin, said Lady Mage.
No, Rob admitted. Victarion will lead the best part of his garrison, I guess. Every man he takes will be one man less we need to fight, however. And he will take many of his captains, count on that. The leaders. He will need such men to speak for him, if he hopes to sit the sea stone chair.
You cannot mean to attack up the causeway, your grace, said Galbot Glover. The approaches are too narrow. There is no way to deploy. No one has ever taken the moat.
From the south, said Rob. But if we can attack from the north and west simultaneously, and take the iron men in the rear, while they are beating off what they think is my main thrust up the causeway, then we have a chance. Once I link up with Lord Bolton and the Freys, I will have more than 12,000 men. I mean to divide them into three battles, and start up the causeway a half day apart. If the Greyjoys have eyes south of the neck, they will see my whole strength rushing headlong at Moat Cailin. Roose Bolton will have the rear guard while I command the centre. Great John, you shall lead the van against Moat Cailin. Your attack must be so fierce that the Ironborn have no leisure to wonder if anyone is creeping down on them from the north.
The Great John chuckled. Your creepers best come fast, or my men will swarm those walls and win the moat before you show your face. I'll make a gift of it to you when you come dawdling up.
That's a gift I should like to have, said Rob. Edmure was frowning.
You talk of attacking the Iron Men in the rear, sire. But how do you mean to get north of them?
There are ways through the neck that are not on any maps, uncle. Ways known only to the Krannock men. Narrow trails between the bugs. And wet roads through the reeds that only boats can follow. He turned to his two messengers. Tell Howland Reed that he is to send guides to me. 2 days after I have started up the causeway, to the centre battle, where my own standard flies, three hosts will leave the twins, but only two will reach Moat Cailin. My own battle will melt away into the neck, to re-emerge on the fever. If we move swiftly, once my uncle's wed, we can all be in position by year's end. We will fall upon the moat from three sides on the first day of the new century, as the Iron Men awaking, with hammers beating at their heads from the mead they quaffed the night before.
"I like this plan," said the Great John. "I like it well."
Galbot Glover rubbed his mouth.
There are risks. If the Krannock men should fail you, we will be no worse than before.
But they will not fail. My father knew the worth of Howland Reed. Rob rolled up the map, and only then looked at Catelyn.
"Mother?" She tensed. "Do you have some part in this for me?"
"Your part is to stay safe. Our journey through the neck will be dangerous, and naught but battle awaits us in the north. But Lord Malister has kindly offered to keep you safe at Seaguard until the war is done. You will be comfortable there, I know.
Is this my punishment for opposing him about Jon Snow, or for being a woman, and worse, a mother? It took her a moment to realize they were all watching her. They had known, she realized. Catelyn should not have been surprised. She had won no friends by freeing the Kingslayer, and more than once she had heard the great John say that women had no place on a battlefield. Her anger must have blazed across her face, because Gorbet Glover spoke up before she said a word.
"My lady, his grace is wise. It's best you do not come with us."
"Seagard will be brightened by your presence, Lady Catelyn," said Lord Jason Mannister.
"You would make me a prisoner?" she said.
"An honoured guest," Lord Jason insisted.
Catelyn turned to her son. "I mean no offence to Lord Jason," she said stiffly, "but if I cannot continue on with you, I would sooner return to Riverrun."
"I left my wife at Riverrun. I want my mother elsewhere. If you keep all your treasures in one purse, you only make it easier for those who would rob you. After the wedding, you shall go to Seagard. That is my royal command."
Rob stood, and as quick as that, her fate was settled. He picked up a sheet of parchment.
"One more matter. Lord Balin has left chaos in his wake, we hope. I would not do the same. Yet I have no son as yet. My brothers Bran and Rickon are dead, and my sister is wed to a Lannister. I've thought long and hard about who might follow me. I command you now, as my true and loyal lords, to fix your seals to this document as witnesses to my decision."
A king indeed, Catelyn thought, defeated. She could only hope that the trap he'd planned for Moat Cailin worked as well as the one in which he'd just caught her.
Samwell.
"White Tree," Sam thought. "Please, let this be White Tree."
He remembered White Tree. White Tree was on the maps he'd drawn on their way north. If this village was White Tree, he knew where they were.
"Please, it has to be."
He wanted that so badly that he forgot his feet for a little bit. He forgot the ache in his calves and his lower back and the stiff frozen fingers he could scarcely feel. He even forgot about Lord Mormont and Craster and the Whites and the others.
"White Tree,"
Sam prayed, to any guard that might be listening. All wildling villages look much alike, though. A huge weirwood grew in the center of this one, but a white tree did not mean White Tree necessarily. Hadn't the weirwood at White Tree been bigger than this one? Maybe he was remembering it wrong. The face carved in the bone-pale trunk was long and sad. Red tears of dried sap leaked from its eyes.
"Was that how it looked when we came north?"
Sam couldn't recall. Around the tree stood a handful of one-room hovels, with sod roofs, a long hall built of logs and grown over with moss, a stone well, a sheepfold. But no sheep, nor any people. The wildlings had gone to join Mance Rayder in the Frostfangs, taking all they owned except their houses. Sam was thankful for that. Night was coming on, and it would be good to sleep beneath a roof for once. He was so tired, it seemed as though he had been walking half his life. His boots were falling to pieces, and all the blisters on his feet had burst and turned to callus. But now he had new blisters under the callus, and his toes were getting frostbitten. But it was either walk or die, Sam knew. Gilly was still weak from childbirth, and carrying the babe besides. She needed the horse more than he did. The second horse had died on them 3 days out from Craster's keep. It was a wonder she lasted that long, poor half-starved thing. Sam's weight had probably done for her. They might have tried riding double, but he was afraid the same thing would happen again.
"It's better that I walk."
Sam left Gilly in the long hall to make a fire
while he poked his head into the hovels. She was better at making fires. He could never seem to get the kindling to catch, and the last time he'd tried to strike a spark, or flint and steel,